nanohub.org.
Online simulation and more for nanotechnology.
All right, great. So today we're going to continue our discussion on Boolean satisfiability. And we will continue the timeline approach that we've been taking. So we've been looking at the key developments in the history of SAT solvers. The last one that we discussed in the previous lecture, which is quite important because it forms the basic structure of all the notable SAT solvers that came after it, which is known as the DPLL algorithm, proposed originally in a paper by Davis, Logman, and Loveland, and later on expanded on by Davis, Putnam, Logman, and Loveland. So it's called the DPLL algorithm in 1962. We went through this towards the end of the previous lecture, but I anticipate that most of you who write SAT solvers will essentially need to understand this in good detail. So I want to be sure that the concepts here are clear. So I'm going to go over this a little more quickly, but go over it one more time. So the DLL algorithm, as I said, is also known as the DPLL algorithm for historical reasons, and it forms the basic framework for many, many modern SAT solvers. The way the basic DPLL algorithm works is conceptually, you can think of it as depth-first search of the search space, right? So we know that the search space consists of the 2 power n for a Boolean formula with n variables, consists of the 2 power n assignments, 0, 1 assignments to those variables. Conceptually, you can represent it as a tree. And essentially what the DPLL algorithm does is that it does a depth-first search on that tree and tries to, of course, to traverse as little of the tree as possible, right? And we'll see how it does that. So you start off with a Boolean formula. Here's an example that we have. At any point during the search, you have a set of assignments that you have made to some of the variables in the formula. You need to keep track of the status of the different clauses in the formula. Based on the assignments that you made to variables, some of the clauses may become satisfied. For example, if you assign C to 1, the last clause is going to become satisfied, right? And so then, you just need to focus on satisfying the other clauses. So at any point in time, you need to keep track of the state of the formula. You also need to keep track of the state of the search, which is what combinations of values to the variables have you already looked at in the past. You don't want to keep doing the same thing over and over again, right? You would like to systematically enumerate the different possibilities, explore the different possibilities. So you need to keep track. The key thing from an implementation point of view is keeping track of the state of the formula and keeping track of the state of the search space, what you've covered thus far. So starting the formula, what you do first is pick a variable and make a decision on this variable, right? So you decide whether to assign the variable to 0 or 1. There are various heuristics that have been proposed that make intelligent choices of both the variable and the value. For now, we'll just make an arbitrary decision. So let's say we pick A and we decide to set A to 0. Now, this is a decision, this is a free decision that you made, right? Because it is a choice that you have made in order to explore the different parts of the search space. This is the first step that you're taking by deciding what if A equals 0. Well, you explore the ramifications of that decision by going to the formula and setting all those clauses where you have A prime to satisfy. Because if A is 0, A prime is 1, and remember, if any of the literals in a clause evaluates to true, then that clause becomes satisfied. So now, if you look at the state of the formula, you update it by saying that the first clause and the last two clauses are now satisfied. Okay? So you made a free decision, keep track of the decision you made, understand what its implication is on the state of the CNF formula that you're trying to satisfy. Then, you still have clauses left to satisfy. So you need to pick another variable and make a decision on it. So again here, let's just arbitrarily assume we picked variable B and we made the decision 0. Now, that decision causes yet another clause to be satisfied, the third from the bottom, because it has a B prime in it. And you still have four clauses left, right? Now, that means you need to make another decision. So hopefully the depth-first analogy is becoming clearer here. You are starting at the root of the search tree and you're exploring it depth-first. You're going down one path towards a leaf. Okay. So the next decision, let's say we make, is picking variable C and deciding to set C to 0. Now, you have C prime in a couple of clauses. So both of those clauses now get satisfied, right? Now you still have a couple of clauses that are yet to be satisfied, right? Remember, for the formula to be satisfiable, each and every one of the clauses have got to be satisfied because it's the conjunction of all of those clauses. So one possibility to further explore how to satisfy these clauses would be to pick the only remaining variable d in this case and try both d equals 0 and d equals 1. However, instead of doing that would essentially amount to exhaustive exploration. And of course, if you happen to get lucky and make intelligent choices, you might end up getting to a satisfying solution or satisfying assignment quickly, but on the other hand, you may not. So in addition to just making intelligent choices, you also need to be able to, like we talked about the pruning techniques, or bounding techniques to be precise in the branch and bound, you need to be able to terminate the search as early as possible in the search tree so that you don't explore all the leaves, you don't explore all 2-to-the-n combinations. In this context, the way you do that is by looking at the 2 remaining clauses and saying, hey, in these 2 remaining clauses that are yet to be satisfied, these 2 remaining clauses have this interesting property that they have 3 literals. 2 of the literals have already been assigned values. A and C have already been made decisions on. D is the only one remaining. So if a clause has not yet been satisfied and all the literals except 1 have been assigned, then what does that mean? It's a special case. It means that last literal is forced. You are forced to assign that last literal to the value that will satisfy the clause, because to satisfy the formula, that is the only hope you have left. You have already assigned values to all the other literals. In this case, you assign A to 0 and C to 0. So that's not going to help you satisfy these clauses. The only way you can satisfy the second clause, is by setting D to 1. And you record that information or deduce that information by constructing what is known as an implication graph, where the nodes or vertices of the implication graph are the decisions you made. For example, A equals 0 is the decision that you made. So that's a vertex or node in the graph. C equals 0 is another decision you made. That's another vertex. And the clause, the existence of the clause A or C or D means that once you've decided A equals 0 and C equals 0, that forces D equals 1 in order to satisfy this clause, because that's the only way left to satisfy this clause. Unfortunately, you also have another clause left to satisfy, and the very same set of decisions A equals 0 and C equals 0, because of this clause, imply that D should be equal to 0, because D prime should be 1. Now, whenever you get opposing forced implications or forced assignments on the same variable, that is a conflict, because you know that a variable cannot take both the values simultaneously. It has to be 0 or it has to be 1. But what you're in a situation where in order to satisfy the CNF formula, you simultaneously need to assign it to both 0 and 1, which cannot happen, right? So this is known as a conflict. And conflicts, this entire graph is called the implication graph, because it keeps track of the implications that arise due to the clauses in the formula and combination of the clauses in the formula and the decisions you have made thus far. Okay, so the utility of trying to construct the implication graph and detect conflicts is that if you detect a conflict early on, before you get to the leaf of the search tree, you are saving yourself from explicitly considering all the combinations of variables corresponding to the subtree rooted at that point. Okay, this is a simple example. You haven't saved a whole lot. You could have tried d equals 0 and d equals 1 and probably gotten away as quickly. But in general, when you have 1,000 variables and you are able to come up with a conflict within 2 or 3 levels of the search tree, that is tremendous savings, because you don't need to make decisions on all the remaining variables. Okay, so what do you do when you have a conflict? Well, first you know that this going down this path or this subtree further is not going to give you a satisfying assignment. The decisions that you made, what it really means is that the combination of decisions that you made thus far, effectively when taken together, mean that this formula cannot be satisfied. Okay, we'll get back to that concept a little bit later in the lecture, but for now we'll just say that it means that this path is useless. Now what you need to do, remember, is you need to exhaustively, in order to The objective of a SAT algorithm is either to find a satisfying assignment or to tell you that there is no satisfying assignment. In order to do that, a complete SAT algorithm has to systematically explore all possible assignments to the variables, right? Explicitly or implicitly. So what you do at this point is you backtrack And in one way of backtracking is to look at the last decision you made. The last decision you made was C equals 0. And say that now let me try the other possible value for C, because I've only tried, you keep track of, this is what I meant when I said you keep track of the state of the search process. You need to keep track at every node in the search tree, if you want to think of that conceptually, whether you explored both the children. Right? In this case, you explored the C equals 0 child and encountered a conflict. You have not yet explored the C equals 1 child, so you backtrack and try C equals 1. Now, this process of trying C equals 1 is a forced decision, because you essentially found a conflict down the other path and that forced you to make this decision, right? Now, once you make set C equals 1, what happens is, and reflect that on the formula, you will see that the two clauses in the middle are still not satisfied. And again, you are in a situation where two of the three variables in each of these clauses has been assigned. And D is the only variable that has not been assigned. So again, if you construct the implication graph based on these two unsatisfied clauses, you will see that A equals 0 and C equals 1, the two decisions that you made, simultaneously require you to set D equals 1 and D equals 0. So again, that's a conflict. So you know that down this subtree, it doesn't make sense to further explore. So now you need to backtrack again, but now if you've been keeping track of the combinations of the values that you tried for the variable, decision variable at each level of this tree, you would know that C, you tried both 0 and 1 for C. So you don't go back to the 0 case, you already tried it. Now what do you do once you've exhausted both the cases at one level? You have to go back to the next higher level and then explore the other possibilities, right? So you backtrack to the B level, and here you know that you only explored the 0 case, you've not explored the 1 case. So now B equals 1 becomes a forced decision, because of the exploration you've done down the B equals 0 tree, you found out that this is not viable. B equals 0 subtree, you found this is not viable, you will not find any satisfying assignment here, so force yourself to go the other way. B equals 1. Now when you go back and reflect B equals 1 on the CNF formula, you see that three of the clauses are satisfied and you still have the five clauses in the middle which are not. Okay? So now you need to do something to satisfy these clauses, right? So now you make a free decision. Let's say you decide to make set C equals 0. That immediately satisfies the three clauses shown here. But then the second and third clause from the top, if you analyze them, you will see that again, the decision A equals 0 and C equals 0 has caused a simultaneous implication on variable D to both 1 and 0. So you know that can't happen again. So that's a conflict here. So you backtrack, force yourself to backtrack again. Now, reflect the decision, the forced decision on the CNF formula. Again, the two clauses in the middle are unsatisfied. If you do the implication graph or implication analysis, you will see that again you have a conflict. So what you need to do now is backtrack. So this node of the search tree has been fully explored. You've explored 0 and 1. Backtrack up one level. Then you will see that, hey, the B node has also been explored. I've considered both the cases. So now backtrack yet another level to the top, to the A level. So now you're trying A equals 0. It turns out that you have just proved that half of the search space cannot give you a satisfying assignment. Anything involving A equals 0 and any other combination of other variables will not work. So now go to the A equals 1 case. This is a forced decision because you already explored A equals 0 and you're backtracking. Make a free decision. Sorry, so setting A equals 1 satisfies four clauses. You still have a few other clauses to be satisfied. You have to pick another variable now. So let's say you pick B and set B to 0. Now setting B to 0 satisfies one further clause. Now, if you look at the two clauses here, shown the two clauses that are yet to be satisfied, you can draw out the implication graph for those two clauses. And you will see that you have a conflict because A equals 1 and B equals 0 simultaneously requires C, in this case, now to be set to 0 and 1. So previously you had conflicts on variable D, now you have a conflict on variable C. So at this point you terminate the search and say that going down the subtree further is not going to be useful. Backtrack at this level of B, that gives you a forced decision. Now, setting A equals 1 and B equals 1 basically satisfies all but one of the clauses, Okay. Now, oh, I'm sorry. Setting A equals 1 and B equals 1 doesn't satisfy, it satisfies a few clauses, but if you look at this clause here, the last clause, you see it has A prime and B or B prime. So A equals 1, B equals 1 will force C to be equal to 1, and that's what I've written here. Now, taking C equals 1 and reflecting it back means that all except one of these clauses is satisfied. Now, this clause, if you further analyze it, it has variables B and C that have already been set to values, either by your own free choice or by forced decisions. And again, if you look at the fact that B equals 1 and C equals 1, since you have B prime and C prime, satisfying this clause forces you to set D equals 1. Okay, so you don't need to consider both all the possibilities. So just starting off with A equals 1 and B equals 1 leads to this sort of implication analysis, forcing you to set values on variables C and D. And at the end, once you do that, it leads to a satisfying assignment. Okay? So in this case, so we've seen two uses of implication analysis. One is to identify conflicts and backtrack when you will not have any solutions, viable solutions in that subtree. But we've also seen another application of implication analysis in this case, which is it is forcing you to make additional decisions without searching, without actually making free decisions or having to enumerate combinations, right? Once you made the decision A equals 1, B equals 1, everything else is dictated for you. Because if you analyze the CNF formula, you have no other choice. Right? The last clause implies that C has to be set to 1, and the clause over here, the fourth one from the bottom, implies that D has to be set to 1 subsequently. Okay? So essentially what this does is rather than implication analysis does is rather than leaving you with having to look at all combinations of variables, it accelerates the process for you. Once you made some decisions, it says, hey, given the decisions you already made and the constraints imposed by the formula, now these are the other things that have to be done. You have no choice. In this case, having no choice is a good thing because it's the number of choices that makes this problem complex, right? The 2 power n. So once you make some decisions, using implication analysis can substantially narrow the size of the search space. Okay. Any questions? Yes, Vikas.
How do you know when to look for the implications?
You always look for the implications. Anytime you make an assignment, we'll talk about it in a second, but throughout the search process. You know, I showed the implication graph only when we had conflicts in this example, just to show its utility. But in an actual implementation, you're always looking for implications. The moment you make a decision, something has changed, you could potentially have new implications. Okay. How to look for implications, I think the next slide or two should address that. Any other questions? Okay. So this seems like a very useful concept, this concept of implication analysis. Sometimes it is also referred to in the literature as Boolean constraint propagation. Yes?
I was pretty slide. One more. Yeah. In this graph, the fifth term is also not, I think, covered. So B prime plus C prime plus D is not also.
Oh, is that right? Do I have a mistake here? Let's see.
I don't know why you green sign there.
That may have corresponded to the previous. Yeah, I think what has happened was that the coloring is from this case when you have C prime. So the moment you backtrack, you're right. The moment you backtrack, this should, when you make the forced decision, this should have been uncolored. Yes, you're right. Right. Because, B prime, B is 1 and C is 1, so both of these are 0. So you will have an additional implication on D equals 1. Okay. But the conflict remains nevertheless. So yeah, I think this is just an error in the coloring. This one has not been satisfied yet. Yeah. This should be unsatisfied. Good observation. Yeah. So, what you need to do, when you implement this algorithm, what you will need to do is the moment you change your decision, remember, if a previous decision made a clause satisfied, and the moment you change the decision, you need to undo that as well, right? I mean, that's what I've forgotten to do here in PowerPoint, but you should not forget to do it in your software implementations. The moment you change any decision, new clauses may be satisfied, or some clauses that were previously satisfied may now become unsatisfied.
Okay. Could you go back to the last slide of this procedure?
The last slide?
Yeah, the last slide. Could you tell me the reason why we did not think about C 4.0? Because in this slide, you do not care about the C equals 0. So.
Oh, why? Why do we force C equals 1?
Yeah.
Okay. At this point, you mean? At this point in the search space, right? Okay. That's because if you analyze the last clause, so let's roll back a bit. I think what happened is I probably skipped a step in the animation here. So the moment you, so this is the status of your CNF formula, right? When with A equals 1, and now you're backtracking to on B, and the moment you set B equals 1, I've skipped a step here in the animation, but essentially what happens is when you set B equals 1, this clause will now have two of its literals 0, because A equals 1 and B equals 1. So A prime and B prime are 0, so that will force C to 1. So you don't need to consider C equals 0 case, right? And that's what is shown by the implication here, right? The decisions A equals 1 and B equals 1 force C equals 1. And once you reflect C equals 1, then this is the state of the formula after you've taken C equals 1 and reflected it back on the CNF formula. What I skipped was the state of the formula, you know, with just A, these two reflected and not that one.
Okay.
And once you do that, now if you look at the last clause, then, you know, B equals 1 and C equals 1 together imply D has to be forced to 1. Any other questions? Okay. So this concept seems to be pretty useful. It is known as implication, and also equivalently referred to as Boolean constraint propagation, okay, in the literature. An implication refers to the process of forcing a variable to be assigned to one of the values, true or false, 1 or 0, based on the previous assignments you made during the search process. Okay. And how can you actually perform these implications? One way of performing implications, of identifying when you can generate new implications or new edges, arrows in that implication graph, is by applying what is known as the unit clause rule. A unit clause is a clause that is currently not satisfied, right? Meaning you don't have any of the literals set to true. But it has exactly one literal which has not been assigned to a value yet. So in other words, remember, a clause can be satisfied, you know, in multiple ways depending on the different literals. So the first clause can be satisfied either by setting A equals 1, B equals 0, or C equals 1. Okay? If you exhausted all but one of the literals in a clause, and the clause is not satisfied yet, that is known as a unit clause. Okay? So in this example, for example, if you look at the simple example here, A with this partial assignment, A has been set to true, B has been set to true, you'll see that the first two clauses have been satisfied. So satisfied clauses by definition are not unit clauses. A unit clause has to be unsatisfied, and it has to have exactly one unassigned literal. So if you look at the third clause, A prime or C prime, A has been assigned, okay, however, you know, the value assigned to A does not make this clause true, and C is the only unassigned variable left in this clause. So this is a unit clause. So if you can identify unit clauses, automatically you can set the last unassigned literal to the appropriate value that will make that clause true. In this case, you'll set C to 0, right? Because that is the only way to satisfy that clause. And again, by the nature of CNF formula, each and every clause has got to be satisfied. Okay, so the specific technique that you use to, or one of the common techniques used to perform implication is to identify unit clauses and pick that last unassigned literal in the unit clause and set that to the appropriate value. Boolean constraint propagation just refers to this iterative or repeated application of this unit clause rule. Why can you repeatedly apply it? Well, once you set C to false, you need to go to all the other clauses in the formula and set the value of C appropriately. Now, another clause which previously had two variables unassigned and therefore was not a unit clause, now may become a unit clause because C was one of those variables, right? So then that this process, much like the pruning techniques we talked about in covering table, in two-level minimization, it's not a one-shot thing. Once you uncover one opportunity and perform the implication, set the value in the CNF formula, you may uncover new opportunities and keep doing that. And in practice, the power of this results from the repeated application of the unit clause rule. And that process is referred to as Boolean constraint propagation. You're recursively or iteratively propagating these Boolean constraints throughout the CNF formula. These concepts, implication analysis, Boolean constraint propagation, conflict detection, these are very key concepts of DPLL and all SAT solvers after that. Okay, so most likely if in your project you choose the option of implementing a SAT solver from scratch, you will have to understand these techniques to the point where you actually are able to write them in code, in software. Okay. So what are the key features of DPLL? One is that it, compared to the previous techniques we saw, if you go back in the timeline, we talked about iterated consensus, resolution, and so on. Resolution was the DP algorithm, the one that we discussed right before this. All of those algorithms required exponential memory because you would keep growing the size of the formula by adding these additional resolution clauses or consensus clauses. And in the worst case, the formula itself could explode. The nice thing about DPLL is that the memory is bounded, right? What do you need to keep track of in DPLL? You need to keep track of the formula with some additional bookkeeping information, you know, which clauses in the formula are satisfied. But that's not a huge amount. It's proportional linear in the size of the formula. It's, you know, just constant amount of overhead per clause. And you need to keep track of the state of the search. Now, state of the search is nothing but you don't need to keep track of the entire tree that or subtree that you've seen thus far. Once you've eliminated a part of the tree, all that you need to do is on each of the nodes, you just need to mark each of the nodes. At any point in time, you are down going down one path of the tree. That's all you need to remember. Everything else is forgotten. Only thing is each node has been marked with, have I looked at the other case or not? So that when you backtrack to that node, you know whether to go down the other branch or go up one more level, right? So again, if you really think about it, even though initially it may appear that you need to keep track of the search space, you need to effectively memorize the entire part of the tree that you explored. In reality, that's not true. You only need to keep track of the current path that you are exploring along with annotations of all the nodes along that path. Okay. So the memory is actually, the benefit of this is that memory explosion is basically eliminated. However, it is still an NP-complete problem, so, you know, it's going to bite you somewhere. Exponential worst case is exponential time, right? So in the worst case, even the DPLL algorithm could go through each and every path through the search tree, okay? So you could still take exponential time because you have to explicitly consider all the 2 to the n possibilities or combinations of variable assignments. Okay. In spite of the fact that this was a big advance, this was a huge advance, it had limited practical applicability, partly because I guess the application drivers were not yet there for using SAT. This was, remember, 1962. And partly because the computers of the time were, you know, really not quite capable from a performance point of view to be able to solve problems of interest. So, you know, it hadn't really reached a tipping point yet. But nevertheless, the foundation of most of the modern SAT solvers was laid back then in these developments. As a homework exercise to be able to understand DPLL, and I think this would be very useful because especially if you plan to implement it, please go try to use this formula and go ahead and actually manually work out the process, the DPLL algorithm, and determine whether this is satisfiable or not. So let me conclude DPLL with a step back and look at some of the general principles that we've learned that we can derive from there. Backtracking, whenever you have decision problems or search problems, when you're searching for through a large space of combinations, backtracking can be an effective approach where you keep track of the search space, keeping exploring it incrementally, and remember what you previously explored in an efficient way so that you systematically explore the solution space. And the use of implications, or conflicts in this case, conflict analysis, significantly reduces the search space, right? Why does it do so? Because whenever you make a forced decision through an implication, you don't need to backtrack on that, right? Because you only need to backtrack, explicitly backtrack on decisions that you made of your, you know, free decisions, decisions that you're not forced to make, right? Whenever you say, what if I set this variable to this value, That's a decision you need to backtrack on. If somebody tells you there's no way out, you have to set the variable to this value. You know, that's the only, you know, that's the only choice. There's no need to backtrack on that decision. So the more implications you have, in a sense, the fewer backtracks you need. Right? Okay. Now let's jump forward by about 24 years to 1986, when a different development in EDA took place. paper by Bryant described this new data structure for representing Boolean functions called BDDs, or binary decision diagrams. We've already quickly seen what BDDs are. Okay. And essentially, these are ways of representing Boolean functions in a compact manner. BDDs are reduced forms of binary decision trees. In a binary decision tree, you essentially look at all possible assignments to the variables. It's a different way of encoding the truth table. But the binary decision tree has an exponential number of leaves and nodes. So what you do in the binary decision diagram is you look at subtrees that are identical to each other and share them. You don't need to repeat them. So by doing that, many times in practice, the size of this reduced graph or the reduced binary decision tree can actually be pretty compact in practice. And here is an example of the reduced binary decision tree, or the BDD, for the truth table shown here. The key We'll talk about BDDs again later in the class, but the important thing to remember at this point, an important property of BDDs, or useful property of BDDs in the context of SAT, is that BDDs are canonical. Remember what canonical means? If you have a function, a Boolean function, there is only one way to represent that Boolean function in that representation, right? A canonical representation is good because it is unique in a sense. There is no ambiguity in what the representation looks like. So how do you use BDDs to solve SAT? Well, the entire CNF formula is a Boolean function, right? Because once you have a set values of all the variables, you can plug it into the formula, and the formula is going to evaluate to true or false, 1 or 0. So the whole formula itself is a Boolean function. Take that Boolean function, represent it as a reduced and ordered BDD. So RoBDDs are special forms of BDDs which obey certain rules when you construct them, right? The construction rules, which ensure both reduction and ordering, these are the properties of the BDD, guarantee canonicity. Okay. Now, if you take a CNF formula and encode it as a BDD, or compute the BDD for that BDD representation for that CNF formula, it turns out that there's only one way, because BDDs are canonical, there's only one way to represent the constant zero function. And that is nothing but a BDD with exactly one node. You'll have the zero leaf node, and the function will directly point to that zero leaf node. That's the only way you have a constant zero function. Right? Any function which is not the constant zero function is satisfiable. Right? We're looking for satisfiability. So take your CNF formula, construct a BDD using the CNF formula, look at it and see if it's the constant zero BDD. That's trivial. If it is not, you know that it is satisfiable. How do you find a satisfying assignment to the variables? Exactly. Find a path from the root node to the one leaf, any path. Each unique path from the root node to the one leaf is a satisfying assignment. So here, for example, setting c equals 1 and b equals 1 is one possibility. That makes the function 1. Or setting c equals 0, b equals 0 and a equals 1 is another possibility. So any of these paths, and if you only care about one satisfying assignment, that's very easy, right? Finding it is just finding whether there exists a path from one node in a graph to another node in a graph. And that is going to give you a satisfying assignment. While this is a valid way of solving SAT, and practically it actually advanced the capabilities of SAT solvers from, you know, order of few tens of variables to hundreds of variables, this is an overkill for SAT. Right? Why is it an overkill for SAT? Why do I say that you're using an unnecessarily heavy hammer here to hit this problem? You need only one solution. The BDD captures all solutions. Right? So you're doing more work than you need to, in a sense. Also, as we will learn later in the class when we talk about BDDs, When BDDs work, they're great. What that means is that, you know, there are certain pathological functions, and unfortunately those functions are encountered often in practice, certain classes of circuits for which the BDD's representations are exponential. For all other functions, BDDs are great. Right? The problem with BDDs is once you constructing them is the problem. Once you construct them, most operations are greatly simplified. So when it works, when you're able to construct the BDD, it works great. But there's many cases when you cannot even construct the BDD. So, you know, this deserves a mention, certainly because it, you know, is applicable in this context of SAT, but BDDs wouldn't quite cut it as a replacement for general purpose SAT solvers. Okay. So we'll move on to a few years later, where there was a development in the area of SAT which came from a different domain. Remember, the two of the popular application areas for SAT, one is electronic design automation, the other is we talked about artificial intelligence. So this time, it turns out most of the developments in SAT practical developments at least happen to have come from the area of design automation. This was one instance of a contribution from the other community that uses SAT. There were two related techniques proposed in artificial intelligence conferences in 92 and 94 respectively. And both of these are based on the principle of local search. Okay. So basically what both of these techniques did was that they took the decision problem. SAT is a decision problem, right? Why do I say that? Because you need to tell whether a formula is satisfiable or not. And if it is satisfiable, give a satisfying assignment, right? It is a decision problem. You can reformulate decision problems as optimization problems. In optimization problems, for example, two-level minimization, you're trying to minimize a certain objective function. Okay? SAT is not inherently an optimization problem, but you can reformulate it or cast it as an optimization problem and use techniques like, which will remind you of the techniques that we used, heuristic techniques that we used in Espresso, to solve it. Okay? So I'll illustrate that using this example. Here you see in a formula, right, with a few clauses. Just for our analysis, for ease of understanding, I have shown the entire search space for this formula. It turns out this formula has only one satisfying assignment. So I've explored all possible values for A, B, and C. You need to set A equals 1, B equals 1, C equals 1. That is the only way you can satisfy this formula. Anything else will make it 0, evaluate to false. Now, the way local search works is that you start off with an initial assignment to the variables, possibly random assignment to the variables, and take those values that you, let's say you pick A equals 0, B equals 1, C equals 0. Take these values, reflect them in the formula. Once you do that, each clause in the formula is either going to be sat or unsat, right? So in this case, it turns out that four of the clauses are sat, and there is one clause which is unsat. Now, you specify a cost function to be the number of unsatisfied clauses. In this case, for this particular value of assignments, A equals 0, B equals 1, C equals 0, the cost function evaluates to a 1. With this information, how do you restate the SAT problem? What do you need to do? What do you're looking for? A solution which minimizes the cost function, and the minimum value you're looking for is 0. If the minimum value of the cost function is 0, then you know that it's a satisfiable formula. If the minimum function is non-zero, is greater than 0, then you know it's an unsatisfiable formula. So you start off with an initial solution, set the appropriate values in the CNF formula, evaluate the cost function. Now, you don't know you haven't gotten to a satisfying assignment yet, so pick one of the variables and flip them. So this initial solution corresponds to this leaf of the tree. So in this case, let's say you randomly pick the value of B and say, I'm going to flip B from 1 to 0. That corresponds to jumping from this leaf of the tree to this leaf of the tree, right? Once you do that, you set the values A equals 0, B equals 0, C equals 0 in the formula, and you'll see that now the cost function has increased to 2. Okay. So now pick another variable. Let's say C. Try to change it from 0 to 1. If you do that and reflect that in the formula, now again the cost, it still remains unsat overall, and the cost function has come down from 2 to 1. Next, try to flip B again. flip B from, in this case, 0 to 1. Cost function is 1. Flip, now try flipping A. You tried flipping B and C. If you try flipping A, it turns out that you will pick the correct value of variables and you jump to the satisfying assignment and the cost function has become 0. So this should remind you of the process of hill climbing that we went through, because you start off with some value of the cost function by picking an initial assignment of variables. Keep heuristically trying out changes, different changes, and in the process your cost function may keep going up and down. During the search process, if you happen to hit the global minimum, great. And if that global minimum is 0, great. You're done. You have a satisfying assignment. Otherwise, well, you're out of luck, right? So these are essentially hill climbing algorithms. The two algorithms that I mentioned, the two publications, are referred to as GSAT and WSAT respectively. But these are basically hill climbing algorithms. They make these local moves by flipping the values of certain variable assignments. These are small, easy, short local moves. And sometimes you accept, occasionally, for example, you could do it probabilistically with some probability that as the search process proceeds, you reduce that probability. Accept moves that make the cost function worse, right? That helps you to exit from these local minima. Now, these are incomplete SAT solvers, right? Why? Because you don't really keep track of the entire search space or try to systematically enumerate the entire search space. You're viewing this as a optimization problem and using optimization heuristics to solve it. So these solvers are geared towards satisfiable instances, meaning that SAT instance, if you know that the application domain that you're getting your SAT problem instances from, these instances are likely to be satisfiable and it's relatively easy to find a satisfying assignment. You don't need to search a whole lot. Then these algorithms work very well, actually more efficiently than DPLL-based algorithms. However, the flip side is that these are incomplete. If you want to prove that a formula is unsatisfiable, for example, verification, that's exactly what we need to do, right? You have two copies of the same circuit. Hopefully, in most cases, you've not made a bug, or if you made a bug, the bug is rather inconspicuous and difficult to find. So these are difficult, quote-unquote, difficult SAT instances, and the common answer you're looking for is unsatisfiable. If that is the kind of situation problem you have, this will not work for you, right? Because these are incomplete SAT solvers. They cannot prove that because they don't keep track of the entire search space. In fact, that's the whole reason why they are so efficient. Make quick moves, change the value of the formula. You don't need to worry about keeping track of the search space or doing any of that implication analysis, conflict analysis, none of that stuff, right? So the moves are very efficient, but in instances where you need to search a lot, you know, these won't really work for you. Okay, moving on. A couple of key developments that followed in SAT were very much driven by the field of design automation. Okay. So this is the time when, if you recall from our earlier discussions on two-level minimization and logic synthesis in general, evolved, you know, in this time, the mid-80s or the 80s was the time when logic-level design automation started gaining root. And so there was a need for some of these EDA design drivers like automatic test pattern generation and equivalence checking started pushing the need for better SAT solvers and practically usable algorithms. At the same time, there was a switch from a benchmarks perspective. Until this point, SAT was completely driven by what I would call sort of random or synthetic benchmarks, meaning that, you know, given a bunch of variables, you can always generate formulae by taking combinations of the variables or their complements, right? These were not representing actual digital circuits. But at this point in time, there was a great demand due to the application demand from SAT. People started coming up with various benchmarks which were derived from circuits. Okay, and there was the two key developments in 88 and 94 respectively. I've clubbed them together because the core principles are really very related to each other. They improved the capacity of SAT solvers by about an order of magnitude. Okay. So the first of these two came from the domain of automatic test pattern generation, a tool known as Socrates, which was developed in Germany. The basic principle, from a SAT perspective, the basic principle that this research contributed to SAT was, can be explained using the following example. Suppose I gave you the circuit and I asked you what will happen if A equals 1. I'm not going to tell you what has the values of B and C are, but if I tell you A equals 1, with your understanding of how gates work, you will immediately say that if A equals 1, these are OR gates, so D and E will automatically become 1, independent of the side inputs. Now, if D and E are both 1, this is an AND gate, so F is going to be 1. In other words, A equals 1 implies F equals 1. Of course, you have those implication relationships locally between the inputs and outputs of gates, but sometimes because of the structure of circuits, even in large circuits, you have these implications between signals which are seemingly unrelated at different points in the circuit. Okay? And you can generate such implications by essentially setting the values of each of the variables to 0 and 1 and just propagating those values forward. Okay? Now, A equals 1 implies F equals 1, but what is interesting in the context of, perhaps even more interesting in the context of SAT, is that this also implies something else. It implies that if F equals 0, it also implies that A should be 0. And that is not as obvious when looking at the circuit, but if you really think about it, for F to be 0, right, either D has got to be 0 or E has got to be 0. One of these two have to be 0. But for D to be 0, both A and B have got to be 0. For E to be 0, on the other hand, A and C have got to be 0. So no matter which case you choose, D equals 0 or E equals 0, in either case, you will end up with the requirement that A should be 0. Stated differently, for F to be 0, A cannot be 1, because if A were 1, it would force F to 1. Right? You're looking for F to be 0. If F has to be 0, A cannot be 1. So A has to be 0, in other words. This is known as the contrapositive. So if you start off with an implication, any implication, this is A implies F, the contrapositive of that is always true, which is F prime implies A prime. Okay? So the key idea in Socrates was essentially to use this relationships between signals that are derived by analyzing the circuit structure and their contrapositives as invariants during the SAT search process. Okay. How do you encode this? How do you use this information during the search process?
We don't have to evaluate that part of the tree that equals to 0.
Correct. You don't have to evaluate that part of the tree, but the way you do it, how do you do it? The way you do it, I guess I hit one extra click here, is by encoding this information as a clause. So remember, you can take the circuit and using the Satan transformation, convert the circuit into a clause. But those clauses will always relate the inputs and outputs of gates. You will never have a clause relating A and F, because these are not related by a gate. However, by doing this kind of analysis, you can add these additional clauses. Right? So, remember, X implies Y can be written as X prime or Y. Right? So, in this case, it is F prime implies A prime. So, that will be written as F or A prime. This is an additional clause that you can add to the CNF formula. This is always true for this circuit. No matter what you're trying to search for or analyze the circuit for, this is just a property of the circuit. So derive additional implications and their contrapositives and add those as clauses to the CNF. You might say, I'm making the problem bigger. It's stupid to do this. Does it make sense to do this? I had a small CNF formula with clauses from each gate. Now you're just telling me to add additional clauses to the CNF formula. So every time I make a decision on any variable, I'm going to have process this one additional clause and check if the variable is there or not, see if it is satisfied. I'm creating more work. But why is this useful? It's useful because this added clause will lead to implications. It helps in more effective Boolean constraint propagation. It will lead to implications faster. It will possibly lead to backtracks faster. It will lead to conflicts faster. Right? So even though the formula is becoming larger, it turns out that the extra overhead, bookkeeping overhead you have to maintain a larger formula is easily outweighed by the benefits that these additional clauses, invariants, bring to you in terms of reduced number of backtracks, reduced search that you have to do. Okay. Any questions? Understand how this works? Okay. Now we will look at Hannibal, which was proposed a few years later, but as I mentioned, the key concept is really the same. They came at the same concept from a different way. Okay. So Hannibal used a technique known as recursive learning. Right? Socrates basically used the contrapositives of implications that they derived by analyzing the circuit, doing forward propagation. Right? Doing forward propagation in the circuit is easy. Doing backward propagation is tough. That's why the contrapositive is great, because it gives you a backward implicant. F comes later in the circuit, and you have some signal later in the circuit implying a signal earlier in the circuit. Right. Now, the way Hannibal came at the problem was, so this came from the domain of equivalence checking for logic verification. Okay, so that is the application context in which this technique was proposed. I illustrated the same circuit so you can see the similarity. So here, if I gave you the circuit again and said F equals 0, as I mentioned earlier, you'll tell me that there's two possibilities there. Right? Either D has got to be 0 or E has got to be 0. Now, what Hannibal said was, okay, let me explore both cases. Okay? Let's first explore the D equals 0 case first. If D equals 0, then this is an OR gate, so you know that A equals 0 and B has got to be 0. Okay. So in a sense, now you're doing these implications backward, but whenever you have a choice, explore both the cases. Okay? So one case is D equals 0, the other case is E equals 0, then A has to be 0 and C has to be 0, because again it's an OR gate with inputs A and C. Now if you look at both the cases, for F equals 0 there are two cases, right? Either D has got to be 0 or E has got to be 0. Now we've explored each of those cases separately, and now when we put the implications from the two cases together, we see that there's one common necessary condition for F to be 0. Okay? That is A equals 0. It's common between both these cases.
Right.
These are not common, but A equals 0 is common to the two. So therefore, you can conclude that F equals 0 can happen in one of two ways, either with D or E being 0. But no matter which way I choose, there is a common implication, which is A equals 0. So again, you basically come to the conclusion that F equals 0 implies A equals 0, because it's common to both the cases. Now, this sounds like a pretty simple process, right? You know, and in fact, what you can do is you can similarly recursively, if I had another level of AND gates here feeding D and E, then either of the inputs of those AND gates could be 0. So you'll have more cases, and you could explore all those cases. The problem is that eventually will be exponential, right? So you cannot do this forever. You cannot do this sort of case splitting. What you've done here is try to backward propagate F, the value here, F equals 0. You know that that implies two cases, analyze each of the cases separately, and see if there's any common implications or signals that are forced to values common between the two scenarios. And take those as the implications of F equals 0. You can repeat this for F equals 1. Similarly, if you have a large circuit, you can take every signal in the circuit and do this kind of backward propagation of implications and do case splitting. Right? You can do case splitting only to a limited extent, because you don't want to have an exponential blow up. But essentially, by doing this case splitting to a limited depth, what they showed in the recursive learning paper was that, in the Hannibal paper, was that by doing this recursive learning to a limited depth, let's say to a depth of 3 or 4, and taking all those invariants or implications that you derive and adding them as the clauses to the CNF formula, the entire search process becomes much, much more efficient. So, to summarize, the key concept in both Socrates and Hannibal is called learning. Okay? So, Socrates first incorporated learning using the concept of contrapositives. You start by setting signals at the inputs of the circuit to some values, propagate them forward, and then use those implications and take the contrapositives of those implications, right? And encode them as clauses, both the original implications and the contrapositives. Hannibal, on the other hand, said, I'm going to go backwards in the first place. Okay. Whenever I have multiple possibilities, I'll do case splitting, explore all the cases to a limited depth, right? And take the common conclusions that I come to, common implications that I come to from all the cases, and then take those to generate additional invariants. And essentially, the net result of in both of these cases is you have these additional constraints that give you non-local information or non-local constraint about signals in the circuit. And adding that to the CNF formula enables SAT solvers to become much more efficient. Okay. However, note that these analyses are from digital circuits, logic circuits. So these techniques are, at least they are primarily proposed in the context of SAT problems that originate from logic circuits. right? Which is exactly what happens in electronic design automation. So you cannot really do this for an arbitrary CNF formula because there is no circuit representation. If you know that you have a circuit representation and the formula was generated from a circuit, by doing some additional analysis on the circuit, in addition to that basic formula you'd have generated, you can generate these additional clauses. Okay. So we'll talk about, see how many more we're able to cover. But the next development came from the area of formal verification or theorem proving, to be precise. And this was an interesting development. This was a development that was originally not published. A gentleman by the name of Stallmark initially filed for a patent in 1990 in the US and later in Europe, or first in Europe actually turns out, and filed and later in the US. They were issued several years later. And only then it came to light that essentially, if you look at the algorithm, you will see that, again, some of the fundamental principles that we saw in Socrates and Hannibal are also reflected in this algorithm. Okay, and this did not really come to light until much later, in 1998, when they actually published this at a conference, and people basically pointed out that, hey, you know, I'm not sure who gave you the patent, but the basic concepts have already been published. Okay, so it was sort of an interesting story. So the basic concept, and the way Stallmark presented their algorithm, or they viewed it is, whenever you have, so you're performing these different branches in SAT solvers, try both sides of a branch to find forced decisions or relationships between variables. So they essentially, what they did was, Stallmark did was, they took the concepts that Hannibal and Socrates talked about in the context of circuits, and they essentially did the same thing, but by doing analysis on the CNF formula itself. So if you start, to give you an example, if you have a formula that looks like this, and start off with that, you can do the analysis of, let me try A equals 0. Now, because of the unit clause rule, you know that A equals 0 implies B equals 1. And again, A equals 0 implies B equals 1, right? So these are implications you get from A equals 0. A equals 0 implies B equals 1 and D equals 1. Now, try the other possible value for A. Try A equals 1. If you say A equals 1 in this formula, the first and last ones are satisfied. The middle two become unit clauses. So, and they result in implications C equals 1 and B equals 1. So, A has to be either 0 or 1. There are two possibilities. I'm exploring both. And using Boolean constraint propagation to find out implications on variables. Now, put these two next to each other. And take the common of the two. And that has to be an invariant that always holds, right? If A equals 0, I'm telling you that for this formula to be satisfied, B has got to be 1. Separately, if A equals 1, you also found out that for the formula to be satisfied, B equals 1. So putting these two together, you can say that no matter what value A takes, it doesn't matter, B has got to be 1 for this formula to be satisfied, no matter what, right? So essentially what you're doing is trying both sides of a branch or both possible assignments to a variable, doing implication analysis, taking the common implications, and saying that those are invariants. And those are essentially forced decisions along any path of the search tree, right? So I've just copied the information, the analysis we did from the previous slide. Both A equals 0 and A equals 1 result in the implication B equals 1. So B has got to be 1, notwithstanding value of anything else. Now, you can do this. We started off with variable A. Okay, and we found out a constraint that B has got to be 1. Similarly, you can start off with any of the other variables and set them to the other to opposite values, 0 or 1, find out common implications and try to discover such invariants, right? So in a sense, this has reduced, finding out this invariant has reduced your search space in half, right? Because B has got, without going down the search tree, just by looking at one level of the search tree, A equals 0 and A equals 1, you've said that B has got to be 1. Repeat this for all variables, but why stop at all variables? Why not take combinations of variables? So you can take pairs of variables. Let's say you say pick A and C. There are four possibilities. 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1. For each of those possibilities, set the values of the variables accordingly in the CNF formula. Do Boolean constraint propagation to identify implications. Now list out the implications you found in all the four cases. Find the common implications. They have to be true no matter what, universally. You can do this for triples. Of course, you know, your amount of work essentially is exponentially exploding, but to a certain limited amount of depth, you can do this and find common implications. Eventually, this is a complete algorithm because if you keep doing it and adding these constraints every time you're reducing the size of the search space, if you keep doing this, eventually you will be able to prove whether the formula is sat or unsat. How long you need to, or how far down this process you go, will dictate how much time you need. Okay. So this is an essence of Stallmark's procedure, and hopefully you see the analogy to especially to recursive learning, right? Where you pick a variable. In that case, the variable happened to be the output of the circuit, but here you're just picking an arbitrary variable in the scene of formula. Okay, so let's see how we're doing on time. Grasp. I think this is a good time to stop because, you know, I'll be, this is probably 15 or 20 slides and I'll be halfway in the middle of it. I think also the amount of material we have left fits nicely into a lecture. So the next lecture will be wrapping up. We'll be talking about GRASP and a couple of subsequent advances in SAT solvers. And in the next lecture, I'll also be talking a little bit about the course project. So and so you can start thinking about forming teams and what you want to work on and so on. Thank you.